Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, with the Mac Observer, and this week my guest is the Executive Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, that's a mouthful, Cindy Cohn. Cindy, good afternoon, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you on the show. We have a mutual friend, Naomi Pierce, and I had Naomi on the show in the early days when I first started. She was a delightful guest, and we got to talking about this was about the time when we were in the height of the Apple versus FBI discussion, which we'll get to in part two of the show. And she said, well, you really ought to talk to Cindy, who's a friend of mine. So she introduced us, and then it happened.
Yep. Yep, she's a good friend. She's a smart cookie, that one.
She is, and I've known her for years. We're very good friends. So you are the executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I'm sure many listeners have heard of your organization, but for those who may have not, just bring us up to date. Talk about the EFF, its founders and its mission, and give us some background.
Well, the EFF was founded in 1990, basically to make sure that when you go online, your rights go with you, whether that involves privacy or free speech or, you know, or any other of the rights that could be implicated by the shift to digital technology. EFF was founded by three people, Mitch Kapor, who is the founder of Lotus Notes. Old timers might remember one of the first spreadsheet programs. John Perry Barlow, who's a philosopher and also very well known as a lyricist for the Grateful Dead and a fun guy all around. And John Gilmore, who is a technologist, open source activist. And they realized 1990, this is before the World Wide Web existed, that when the rest of us started using some of this technology that was really still only available largely to people in large institutions, be they universities or research institutions, that it was going to have a profound impact on society. And I'd venture to say that they were right. And they founded EFF to make sure that there was a strong voice for making sure that our free speech and our freedoms continue when we go online. EFF was founded in part in response to some law enforcement actions against people who were running early bulletin board systems, BBS systems, where law enforcement thought that something bad was happening on the BBS, did a raid on people's houses. One of the very first famous ones was on a little game company called Steve Jackson Games, and basically took everything that was plugged into the wall. And shut down this game company and actually nearly caused it to go out of business. And so the founding case of EFF was really about making sure that when the government is taking actions online, that it understands the technology it's dealing with and makes reasonable and proportional decisions for how it operates. And I think it's fair to say that 26 years later now, that is still central to what we're doing, because we still have ongoing conversation with law enforcement and now the national security people about, you know, how to best protect our rights and freedoms while we are also working to protect our safety.
How did that original case turn out?
Well, ultimately, Steve Jackson got all his stuff back, and we were successful in getting, it was the Secret Service that actually did the raid, in getting one of the first strong opinions issued, confirming that the government has to think about proportionality and limits on what it does when it engages in law enforcement activities online. So the Steve Jackson Games case is still a very important case in kind of digital Fourth Amendment and digital digital law.
Were you involved in the early days of the so-called crypto wars when the government tried to legislate what level of encryption we could have on our computers?
Yes, I was. One of the second or third early things that EFF took on was this question about whether we were going to have access to technology that let us be secure and have privacy online. And it's called the first crypto wars. And I was in private practice at that time. I wasn't at the EFF directly, but I got asked by some of the folks at the EFF to handle a lawsuit against the government's export restrictions on strong cryptography. In the 1990s, cryptography was something that you couldn't post online unless you got a license from the government. And the license didn't, you know, you didn't get one if the cryptography wasn't weak. And we challenged those regulations under the First Amendment, and we won. And the licensing scheme was declared unconstitutional. The government sought to appeal that decision. We won in the first court, and we won in the second court, which was the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. While the government was seeking to appeal that decision further, they actually dropped their regulation of strong crypto. And that's why, in part, why you have strong crypto in your computer right now. If you've ever, you know, bought something online and seen that little lock, or used any kind of security online.
The modern internet banking and commerce couldn't exist without it.
That's right. And so that early case that we did in the 1990s is really key. And there were efforts in Congress, and there were efforts in the public debate as well. But the litigation was certainly one of the things that led to the government dropping its licensing scheme, and then ultimately dropping its other plans, some of which your listeners may have heard of, called the Clipper Chip and some other things that to try to force everybody into basically dumbed down security online.
So what is the source of the Electronic Frontiers Electronic Frontier Foundation funding? Is that an initial endowment, or do you have a continuing source of income?
We have a very much a continuing source of income. We do have an endowment, but it's not very it's nice, but it's only a small source of our income every year. Now, EFF is largely supported by the community. Individual donations make up well over 50% of our income. Some of them from individual donors. Regular people can join EFF, and we have over 26,000 dues-paying members at EFF. You get nice t-shirts and stickers and hats and stuff along with that membership. But just regular people with small donations are well over about a quarter of our funding. Another quarter of our funding comes from individuals as well, but kind of the people who can write bigger checks. That's probably close to another quarter. And then we get money from some foundations. We get a little bit of corporate money, but it's pretty small. And we also have a couple of companies that run projects that end up supporting us. So one of the big ones, Cards Against Humanity, this year put out a pack of cards that are focused on the internet. They have donated the proceeds of those cards to us. There's a group called the Humble Indie Bundle, which sells independent games, and they run bundles where people can pay what they want for the games, but also give money to charities. And EFF has been one of those charities for a while. So all sorts of things. Really, it's a very mixed portfolio of funding sources that we have. And a lot of them, like the Cards Against Humanity and the Humble Bundle stuff, is really fun.
You mentioned the corporations that fund you. Is it public knowledge whether or not companies like Microsoft and Apple support you?
We get a small amount of corporate donations. Most of it's available on our website. I will tell you, for instance, in 2015, we raised $16 million, and of that, $700,000 came from corporations. So we have corporate money, but if anybody thinks that an organization of $16 million can be bought by a $700,000, and that's from all the corporate donations together, I got a bridge I want to sell you. We are not bought by anybody.
Good to hear. Well, tell me about how you got into this. Tell me about your early career. You started off as an attorney. You started earlier. How did all this come to pass leading up to the joining the EFF?
Well, I was a young lawyer, and I was interested in international human rights work. I actually worked at the United Nations Center for Human Rights right out of law school. and came back to the Bay Area and started practicing, you know, regular litigation law, but was very, very interested in these questions of human rights and people's rights and how's the government structured in a way that maximizes freedom. And kind of randomly, I met John Gilmore, who's one of the founders of EFF, through a mutual friend, and just became very interested in what he and a bunch of these people involved in tech, you know, pre-World Wide Web, were doing, and the implications it have for the world. I knew John just as they were founding EFF. I thought it was a really important and cool idea, but I'm not a particularly technical person. I mean, I've kind of become one, but at the time, I was an English major. I'm not particularly technical, although I've played around with some computers. I actually programmed using punch cards when I was in high school. So I got interested in what they were doing and this conversation.
How am I talking to you? Are you on a Mac?
I am on a Mac.
MacBook Pro, I would guess.
It is a MacBook Pro. Ah, you're correct.
Yes. Do I win a prize? Do I get a t-shirt? What year was this when you joined?
Well, I joined EFF in 2000, but it was about 1993 when John asked me if I wanted to do the cryptography case. It was called Bernstein versus Department of Justice, and I represented a PhD student at UC Berkeley who had written a computer program and wanted to post it online in a news group about cryptography, and was, you know, told that if he did, he'd go to jail as an arms dealer. And so that was the central
case.
Yeah, it was crazy, you know, and it's still the same though. You know, we just helped somebody who was looking for a license, to export something that's on the export list. And the same thing happened to this person that happened to, Dan in the 90s, which was when we asked for permission, the government just never answered. They just never answered. And so, you know, this other one that I can't really talk too much more about, but the question is, you know, do we have to just sue? And so, you know, one of the reasons that we're very nervous about government regulation is it just really puts a lot of power in the hands of government bureaucrats who, you know, don't have to make a decision even if something's politically difficult. They can just sit on it and deny you, you know, the ability to publish your information. So I was a young lawyer just starting my private practice. I'd come back from the UN when I met John, and John called me one day and said, you know, I've got this guy who wants to publish a computer program online, and the government says that if he doesn't get a license, he'll go to jail as an arms dealer. And I said, well, John, what does this thing do? Does it blow things up? And he said, no, it keeps things secret. And I said, well, that sounds like a First Amendment problem to me. And he said, me too. Will you take the case? And I went to my law firm and I said, well, I think this internet thing is going to be big, and I want to do this case. Would you let me? And they said, knock yourself out. Go do this case. So we did the case for free. And it ended up being, you know, I think a pretty important case. We knew it was going to be important at the time.
I heard about that case.
Yeah, we knew it was going to be important at the time, but I think it's actually even surpassed all of our thinking about how important it would be. And as I said, I think the fact that that case, along with a lot of other things, really set the scale, set the stage for the internet. You know, the internet we have today, both the good and the bad. The good in that we actually do have lots of tools that we can use to help keep ourselves secure, and some of them even operate without us knowing them. That they're there. We don't have to be particularly technical to use a lot of things like Apple's iMessage.
Sure.
But it also set the stage for the fights we're having today about strong crypto, because even in the 90s, the government was very hostile to the idea that we could have a private conversation or a private association online that they would not have access to.
I want to get to that in the second half of the show. But prior to this recent kerfuffle on encryption, what was one of the biggest, most notable EFF cases, may I say, be back way early in the year?
Well, I would say that the first big case that we did that we helped with was a case called ACLU versus Reno that held that the internet was a place of, you know, First Amendment, that the First Amendment applied to the internet. We were important to that case, although our friends at the ACLU really put it together, and a very awesome lawyer named Bruce Ennis argued it at the Supreme Court. And that really also, again, was fundamental to the internet we enjoyed.
Right. I hadn't heard about that, but that does seem so fundamental.
Yeah, and it wasn't at all clear. I mean, it was always clear to us, but there was certainly a very strong argument that the internet was just a place, it was just a cesspool for people, you know, talking about sex, and, you know, it could be very dangerous and blah, blah, blah. And so therefore, it shouldn't enjoy full First Amendment protection. And the Supreme Court, in a 9-0 decision, said, absolutely, this is a place of freedom of expression, and the First Amendment should apply. And so, again, I think it's hard to think about very many things on the internet that aren't in some level dependent on that early ruling, or that wouldn't be significantly different if we'd lost that early ruling.
Wow, that's amazing. So recently you became the executive director.
Yep.
Was that something that you had been wanting to do for a long time? Felt like you could make a difference?
Honestly, I was the legal director for 15 years, and Sherry Steele, who now runs the Tor Project, was our executive director, and it was, in my view, perfect. I would have stayed in that role as long as Sherry was leading. We really enjoyed working together, but the time came, then Sherry's husband got a job in Seattle, so they moved to Seattle, and EFF, the way EFF works, you really need to be here in San Francisco to be the boss. And so Sherry asked me if I would take her old job and step up to be executive director. And it's been fun. It's been about 15 months now. I have to say that I really, really loved being EFF's legal director. I joke that I had the best job in the world, and I got demoted to the second best job in the world.
Well, what do you do all day long? Are you mostly in court, or are you just helping the other lawyers on staff, or managing the funds? What is your daily life like?
Well, all of the above. The buck stops with me, but I was much more involved in the legal cases when I was legal director, and now my colleague and friend Corinne McSherry does that. So I do less of the legal work now than I used to, and much more of the, you know, administrative work, overseeing we have an awesome development team, but I also, you know, am very involved in, helping, do asks for money, helping thinking about how our fundraising work.
Oh yeah, raising money. That's your probably a big job.
It's a piece of it. We have an awesome team and a really supportive community. So unlike other ED jobs, it's not as much of my time as I think it is for others. But also just, you know, we're 75 people now. And so, you know, kind of helping with administration, helping the managers of the various teams kind of keep everything moving, figuring out where things are not working smoothly, and trying to step in and figure out how to help make them smooth, I get to think a little bit, you know, looking over the horizon, where should we go, what should we do next,
exactly,
kinds of things. And so that part's really fun. But, you know, in my heart of hearts, I'm still a lawyer. And so I miss getting, you know, kind of really, you know, arms deep in the legal cases. I don't get to do as much of that as I used to. But the other stuff is great, too.
I'll tell you what, we're going to need to take a short break right now. When we return, how about if we talk about the FBI versus Apple? There's so much to talk about there.
Happy to.
All right, great. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds with Cindy. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
We're back. Thanks, Kelly. We're talking with Cindy Cohen, the Executive Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And we're going to talk about the FBI versus Apple. So what first came up on your radar on this? And how did you first hear about what was going on?
Well, before the case in California, there was a case last fall in Brooklyn, in the Eastern District of New York, where the FBI was wanting to break into an older model iPhone and trying to get Apple to break into it. And they used some of the same arguments that they ended up using in the California case. And we got asked to write an amicus brief, and we joined with the ACLU in this, kind of outlining the problems in what the government was trying to get Apple to do. So we knew that this was kind of percolating around and that they might try again. And so then come this, I think it was late January, early February, I heard from Apple's lawyers again, their outside lawyers, and they said there's another case. And it's about to be, the government has, the case in Brooklyn we knew a little bit about, but it was largely under seal. When the lawyers for Apple called me, they said the government is unsealing one of these cases in California.
Just because they hope to garner some public support, right?
That's right. The case, of course, is, as most people know, arose out of the very horrible San Bernardino terrorist attack. And the FBI, I think, decided that they could convince a lot of people to let them do what they wanted to do because the context of the story there was so awful. So the government decided to unseal what was going on in that case. And so Apple called us and said, this is about to happen. It's going to get unsealed. And we want to fight. We want to fight. We don't want to have to dumb down or attack our own security. Are you with us? And I said, you know, we've been trying to get you guys to use encryption since the 1990s, and you're finally doing it. So, of course, we're going to stand with you. You're doing the right thing by your customers. And when you do the right thing by your customers, we're happy to stand with you. And so they said, great. And then it was probably less than 3 or 4 hours later when the story broke and we learned what the actual case was about. But by then, at least, we knew it was coming. And I had pulled together kind of the core lawyers at EFF and told them that this was coming and that, you know, we all kind of had our theories, but because we knew about the Brooklyn case, we knew what the government's likely arguments were going to be. And it turned out that they were very, very similar. So that's how we found out about it. And we had a blog post ready very quickly to say that we thought, you know, Apple was doing the right thing here, and that we should support them, and that this was really about everybody's security.
Let's frame the argument here and back up a second. So in a couple of sentences, frame the argument by the government and what their motivation and needs are, and then put your other hat on and then explain why Apple did what it did.
So what the government said was, we found this phone. It's one of the phones used by this guy who did this horrible terrorist attack. It's encrypted, and we want Apple to get us access to what's inside that phone in case there's evidence that could be useful to us. And because they wanted to leave no stone unturned in this investigation. And that was their argument. And what Apple said was, well, we can't open the phone because the phone is created such that no third party has the ability to backdoor into it. So what you really want us to do, what you're asking us to do, is to write a program to break our own encryption. And we won't do that.
There's a substitute operating system called the government OS we heard about.
Yeah, that's what they called it. And that we are not going to do that because building this kind of attack on our phones will inevitably lead to everybody's phones who use this same, you know, it was an older model iPhone, but not that old, to being vulnerable. And we we don't want to put all our, you know, as much as we care about this case, we don't want to put all of our phone users at risk. And importantly, of course, Apple helped the government a lot. They gave him all the information.
They gave him the iCloud backups.
They gave him the iCloud backups. This guy was a Verizon customer, so they had all the metadata from Verizon as well about who this guy called and when he called him and how often he called him. Apple helped them quite a bit, but Apple said, you know, look, we're drawing the line on you asking us to break our own security. We don't think that's the right thing to do for all of the rest of our customers.
Do you think Apple made that case plain enough? Because it's obvious that if there's a backdoor created or there's an operating system that could be lost in the wild and sought after by foreign governments and stolen and removed from government servers by evil entities, and then all of our phones would be potentially compromised. Given the obviousness of that scenario, how is it that some government officials didn't quite get what was happening? For example, Senator Dianne Feinstein said, in regard to Apple's refusal to help it to a great extent, to, you know, writing this operating system. So refusing to help law enforcement and the intelligence community risks the safety of all Americans. How is it that she was able to justify such a statement? And what was wrong with Apple's PR that those kinds of cleverly worded statements were able to make hay?
Well, I actually think that Apple won the day at the end of it. I think that what happened was that, you know, the government in these scenarios always gets the first bite, right? The first bite at the story. And, Apple was being portrayed as unpatriotic, and the story is, so, you know, why can't you help us in the San Bernardino attack? I think that the obviousness of the unreasonableness of what the government was asking Apple was very, very clear to people who understand technology and not at all clear to people who don't. And I think, you know, I mean, Senator Feinstein has a long history of being very, very aggressively aggressively in favor of whatever law enforcement and national security wants. She is one of their biggest champions, and has been for years.
But Lindsey Graham got a briefing, and he saw the light and turned around completely. No one briefed Senator Feinstein?
Well, I don't think Feinstein was interested in being briefed. And remember, Feinstein's story came out right away, and Graham originally was on the same side as Feinstein, and it wasn't until the national security people gave him a briefing that I don't know that whether Senator Feinstein went there or not, that Graham flipped. And that's really one of the things that changed. So, again, I think Apple, as with most defendants in most cases, starts off underneath, right? Because the weight of American law enforcement saying we need to do this in order to catch somebody who's done a terrorist attack is a very, very powerful voice. And so I think Apple did a really good job of battling that back. It just didn't happen right away. It took a little while. But ultimately, you know, I feel that the government decided not to continue to pursue this anymore because Apple was winning.
Well, just the other day, I read, and the Mac Observer wrote about it, that FBI Director James Comey at a conference said he wanted to sort of renew the discussion. And according to the Wall Street Journal, he lamented that we're moving to a, quote, we're moving to a place where wide swaths of American life are absolutely private, unquote, what he has called going dark in the past. Is that really true, or are we thankfully kind of like recovering our privacy and security from mass surveillance?
Well, I think it's truer that we're recovering in it. First of all, this idea that it's using privacy as if it's a bad thing is a little troubling for me, because I think privacy is fundamental to human dignity, right? You know, I think that you can't have a free society unless people have a private space. And, you know, every social movement
that's
that
an important
we,
point. A private
every
space.
Every social movement that we enjoy as a country started with a private conversation. Somebody had to turn to somebody else and say, you know, I'm not comfortable with slavery. And that communication could not be a public communication that was available to the government at the time it happened. And in my lifetime, it has been a dangerous thing for people to say, I think gay people should be married. I think gay people should have extra rights. Should have equal rights. I think that the police are over policing African Americans in a way that is very, very dangerous and is causing people to die. These are all conversations that we're now having publicly. Believe me, they all started with private conversations. And if the government is able to know everything that anybody is ever saying at its choice, at its whim, it's going to be very, very hard to have the next social movement get started, because it all starts from a private space. So I care about this because I think that a self-governing country has to have a space where people are not being, are not vulnerable to being watched by their government. That doesn't mean the government's watching everybody all the time, although they're coming close to that capability now. It means that they might be. And I think private spaces are what help keep us free. And so I find that, you know, I'll get, you know, we can go to the substance of what Mr. Comey said, but I think this framing of this is if people wanting privacy is somehow a bad thing and something that should be looked upon with skepticism is profoundly un-American.
Given that need for privacy, the government seems to not be acknowledging that in the spirit of the founding fathers and the spirit of the American way of thinking and freedoms and the constitutional thoughts. It seems to me, I may be wrong, that the government feels like there must be a legislative and technical path to perfect law enforcement. And anything that gets in the way of perfect law enforcement, even if it's a private space, must be done away with. And so one of the things you might imagine the government saying is that, well, you all have cameras in your iPhones. We need to keep an eye on you. So yep. We need access to that phone. So where does it stop? Where does the government sort of get a perspective about how far it's going, or does it?
I think it does when we tell it to. I mean, again, we are still in the remnants of a democracy here, and remnants, that may be overstating it. Sorry, it's been I don't mean to get too carried away. I think that we are supposed to be self-governing in this country, and we still have a lot of mechanisms at our place. And what we need to do is we need to say loud and clear, this far and no further to law enforcement. And I think one of the things that's been difficult for folks in the last decade and a half is that law enforcement continues to push its agenda, as I think it probably always has. The people who are trying to keep us safe, I think they view their job as doing everything they possibly can to try to make their jobs easier and make sure that there's no crime, that there's perfect enforcement. But what needs to be balanced with people in policymaking positions and legal positions like judges saying, no, there's a balance here, and there are people's rights on the other side of it, and you can't have that right, law enforcement. You don't, just because you can do this doesn't mean that we're going to let you. I mean, that's certainly, you know, we have all, I would say that many of our laws, and certainly our founding laws in this country, are based on the idea that there has to be limits to what law enforcement can do. Even if they have the best of intentions, there has to be limits on what they do. And we as a society need to step up and articulate those limits. And I think that's really been missing, and it's been missing in Congress. And it's been missing in the public debate, as I think a lot of people, I mean, more people are concerned about this than ever before since I've been doing this work, which is really good news. The bad news is I think there's a lot of people who feel like they're just giving it up, like they just got to give it up. This is all hope is lost, and the government is just going to do whatever it's going to do, and we don't have any power anymore. And I think at that moment, it's very, very troubling, right? Because it's hard to argue that we're self-governing anymore
right.
at that
point. Right. That was what I was worried about when I was talking before about the phrasing of the argument. There are certain psychological approaches and clever verbal approaches that convince people that perfect law enforcement trumps your right to privacy.
Yep.
Do you think there is, in light of that, Tim Cook said there is a need for legislation to resolve this issue. And in that conference I mentioned earlier that where FBI Director James Comey spoke, he said, there's no devil here. We need to work on, you know, both sides' agenda. Is it even possible to generate legislation that solves this problem? Or is it, as you perhaps suggested, an absolute?
Well, I think that there's lots of legislation that could be considered, but if the founding thing of the legislation is that the government has to have perfect access to everybody's communications, then no, the answer is no. That's not something I'm willing to. I think we should negotiate away, because that's too much. That's negotiating away too much. But I do think we need clearer rules for what law enforcement can and can't do. Can law enforcement go to Apple and say, look, we need you to rewrite your operating system so that we can always have access? There's legislation that's been proposed in Congress right now by Senator Wyden and others that says no, that basically tells law enforcement that's too far. You cannot do that. There's positive things we can do to try to protect people's privacy through legislation. But I think when Comey's talking about legislation, he's saying, let's negotiate the terms upon which nobody has any privacy anymore. And that's a non-starter, but that doesn't mean there aren't legislative things that we could do to shore up people's privacy. And more importantly, I guess, or equally importantly, we've been talking about this from privacy, but I think that the security arguments are equally strong. We know that cryptography, like that Apple uses, is as much about people keeping people secure as it is allowing them to have privacy. We know that, I believe, I'll get my numbers a little off, there were 3 million iPhones stolen in 2013, and another 1 million of them lost. Apple secures the iPhone with the data encrypted at rest, the thing it wanted Apple to break, so that when you lose your iPhone, you don't lose all your data.
Right.
So that somebody can't pick up your iPhone that you've left at a bar and take money out of your bank account. You know, anybody who runs things on there, they can't go to Facebook and steal all your data or start tweeting as if they were you in a way that could ruin your life.
Given that, is it really that important for law enforcement to get into your phone? I was reading the Time magazine article about Tim Cook, the March 28th issue of Time, and they suggested that there are a lot lower hanging fruits for the government in terms of metadata. General Hayden has talked about this. He was former NSA director. There's tracking services. There's a wealth of information that companies collect about you in the normal course of doing business, your airline reservations, all the things that you do that get stored on external servers. Would it not be more beneficial to stop attacking people's privacy place and the importance of the security of their phone and maybe go to these web sources where a warrant would work better?
Well, I do think that one of the things that, there may be situations in which law enforcement has a legitimate need to get into an iPhone, and they're welcome to try, I think. There are lots of ways that, it turned out even in the Apple versus FBI case, Apple had FBI found a way into that iPhone. But I think your larger point is a good one, which is, there is so much information about us available in plain text all around the world, and easily available to law enforcement, whether that's through our ISPs, through our service providers, or all the things that you suggest, that the time in which the law enforcement needs to go to actually the data that's sitting on your iPhone in order to find out what they need to find out is probably a pretty small small set of circumstances, and it's important to remember that one of a former government official who's a guy named Peter Schweier, who's a pretty famous privacy law professor, was on the President's Review Committee, for instance. He calls this the golden age of surveillance for law enforcement. This argument that the FBI is going dark is one that I don't think is true as an empirical matter. If you look at all of the new sources of information that are available to them in the digital age that they didn't have, right, when you and I could go out into a field and have a private conversation, there might be no record of that. When we have a private conversation online, our ISPs know that we're talking. They may not know the content if we use encryption, but they'll have the metadata, they'll have the time, date, and all of that information. So this is why Professor Schweier says this is a golden age of surveillance, and I think that's really true. It makes people like me look at the FBI claiming they're going dark and kind of raise our eyebrows and go, huh? This has been better for you guys.
We're running out of time, so I want to ask one final question. Some people have accused.
Oh, good.
Some people have accused Apple of looking out solely for its own business interests, taking up the mantle of our First Amendment rights and fighting against the government. Is Apple just looking out for its own financial interest to sell more phones, or do you think Apple's interests align with ours?
I think both are true. I think Apple's interests align with ours, and Apple wants to sell more phones. Apple understands that with all of these phones being lost, they had a horrible problem with people breaking in and getting access to stored data on iTunes from movie stars and stuff. And they embarked on a process of trying to make their tools much more secure. And they can, as they will point out, because unlike some of their competitors, they don't make their money off of selling data about you. They make it by selling you a shiny silver shiny gold or silver, but a shiny device, right? Their business model is not nearly as dependent on knowing access to...
That's what we love about Apple. That's why we trust Apple. That's why we're Apple customers. That's why I write about Apple.
I think there's a lot to be said for that. And so this is an instance where our interests and Apple's financial interests really aligned. I will say that I don't think picking a fight with the FBI was really a financial decision on Apple's part, though. I have to say, first of all, Apple didn't pick the fight. The FBI did. The FBI unsealed this information, and they chose this case, and they chose to demonize Apple and try to make them look bad here. So mm-hmm. I really view Apple as trying to protect itself in this instance. Now, EFF has been very critical of Apple, so I am not an Apple fangirl. There's lots of things that Apple does that I don't like, but I do think that this wasn't a business decision on Apple's part in the short term. It certainly is no fun, even if you're the world's most highly capitalized company, to get into a fight with the FBI. There were a lot of people who didn't like what Apple did. I think Donald Trump called for a boycott of Apple as a result. This. And so I don't think that anybody, giving advice to Tim Cook said, geez, this will be a great business move for you to do this. I think that they do have the broader security of their customers in mind. They, of course, have that because they want to sell more phones. But this particular fight, I'm not sure it's one that they would have picked if they weren't forced into it.
Look into your crystal ball here at the very end of the show for a second and tell us what you think is going to happen next. Do you have any intuition about what might happen? I know we're in an election year and interest is focused elsewhere, but say 2017, if this comes up again, how do you see things going?
Well, I think that one thing that this big Apple FBI fight has done is it's awakened a lot of people in the tech community who understand the importance of strong encryption and strong security to this issue. So I feel like we have a pretty strong posse, but I also think the FBI isn't going away, and I think they're going to wait for the next opportunity when they think they've got good optics.
Sure.
And they're going to try to push for this again. They still have strong friends in Congress about this. Senator Feinstein is not up for re-election. And so I do think that we are going to have to be vigilant, and that they are going to come back. And they're going to come back both directly in the context of maybe a proposed law, but also indirectly, trying to get companies to voluntarily dumb down their security.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we do have to be vigilant. We have to pay attention. Yep, and we have to support the companies and the people who are building strong, secure tools for us. And of course, as ED of EFF, hopefully support the organizations that are going to be there we've been here since the 90s. We understand how important a secure internet and secure tools are to people, and we're going to keep standing up for them.
Excellent, excellent. Keep on fighting. And donate to the EFF.org.
Yep, EFF.org. Donate right at the front of it. We've got some fun things going on now. We actually have a promotion going right now where we have EFF-branded dice that we will send you that you can use to generate random passwords and a little how-to about how to generate really secure passwords for yourself using dice. Some of your listeners might know about Diceware. That's the model that we're using. But in general, we are EFF. Apple.org. There's donate links prominently there. There's also, you can find my bio if people want to talk to me. You can send me an email note as well. But
how can the listeners contact you directly?
Well, I'm Cindy at EFF.org, and I do respond to most of my email, and I'm happy to hear from listeners about what we're doing and where we're going. But the website is full. We are an extremely transparent organization. If you want to know if we're doing X, go to the website and look in the search bar, and you'll probably find it a lot faster than emailing me. We have a very robust set of issues that we're working on beyond digital security, although that is certainly one that is near and dear to my heart.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Cindy, we really are out of time. I want to thank you so much for being on the show. This has been a splendid discussion. It's great to hear your thoughts on this, and we're all behind you. So carry on, and thank
all
you
right.
for doing what you do. Listeners, I'm glad you came by. Thanks so much for joining us on the show. I really appreciate you coming to see Background Mode whenever you can. So we'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.